people that were responsible for concealing this crime for decades. In all the other instances, USC, Michigan, there were people that were brought forward and charged, and they are complicit. These people are complicit with his crime.
Well, we have to leave it there, but I thank you so much for being with us and highly recommend this ProPublica New York Magazine expose. Lori Kanyuk is a survivor of Dr. Robert Hatton. Laura Beale and Bianca Fortis co-wrote the investigation, How Columbia Ignored Women, Undermined Prosecutors, and Protected a Predator for more than 20 years. Laura Beale also hosts the new podcast, Exposed Cover-Up, at Columbia University. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
What is climate change? How is it affecting our lives? And what can we do about it? We'll connect the dots, from energy to extreme weather, public health, and more. I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz. Join me for Climate Connections during the evening news, weekdays at 5 p.m. here on 90.7 KBOO Portland.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and the Portland Bureau of Transportation, currently seeking input from those living and working in or who regularly visit the Boise neighborhood about parking issues. Survey responses will help inform a parking management plan for the area. More information at portland.gov/Boise parking.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler will not seek re-election for a third term.
The state of Oregon sues the Fox Corporation over pension funds.
And in national news, certain over-the-counter cold medications may not actually be effective.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 13th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Althea Billings. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler will not seek a third term in office. That's according to a letter shared to the public today. In it, he said that serving as Portland's mayor, quote, has been both humbling and the greatest privilege, end quote. Wheeler also writes that he's interested in overseeing the city's transition to a new form of government, which begins in 2025. This includes a new unelected city administrator role. Wheeler has previously said, though, that he's not interested in being city administrator. The race for mayor in 2024 hasn't kicked off yet, but there are already two declared candidates, Commissioner Mingus Mapps and Portlander Darrell Kinsey Bay. Wheeler hasn't necessarily ruled out running for other elected offices. Prior to becoming mayor, Wheeler served as the Oregon State Treasurer from 2010 to 2016.
The state of Oregon and City of New York's pension funds sued the Fox Corporation for breach of fiduciary duty on Tuesday. That means Fox has a legal responsibility to act in the best interest of shareholders, including Oregon's pension fund. Oregon says that Fox took massive risks in promoting various lies and false stories, which hurt Oregon's pension investment. Ellen Rosenblum is Oregon's attorney general. She says that Fox's reporting exposed them to liability and defamation lawsuits. Rosenblum said, quote, "We look forward to making our case in court," end quote. Oregon owns roughly 5.2 million in shares of the Fox Corporation, which owns Fox News. In April, Fox settled a lawsuit with Dominion Voting Machines for $787 million. Fox had made false claims about Dominion, accusing them of participating in the rigging of the 2020 presidential election. A second voting machine company is still fighting for its share of $2.7 billion in a case against Fox. Fox has not yet responded to that lawsuit.
Certain over-the-counter cold medications may not be effective, according to the Food and Drug Administration. Phenylephrine is a nasal decongestant found in various Sudafed, Tylenol, NyQuil, and Mucinex products. On Tuesday, an advisory panel to the FDA agreed that the drug was ineffective. Phenylephrine is rendered inactive by an enzyme in the gut, so less than 1% of what you swallow makes its way into the bloodstream. The FDA now has to decide if it will remove it from its list of approved over-the-counter medications. If it is removed, it will no longer be allowed to be sold in the U.S., and stores will have to remove it from their shelves. The FDA usually follows the recommendations of its expert panels, but it doesn't have to, and it could be some months before a final decision is made. In the meantime, experts say people shouldn't panic or toss out their medications. Medications with phenylephrine are still safe and contain other ingredients that can help ease cold symptoms. Phenylephrine is in at least 250 products that made nearly $1.8 billion in sales last year. In the early 2000s, phenylephrine was subbed for pseudoephedrine in cold medications in response to the concern that it was being used to make methamphetamine.
The man who is charged with stabbing two black teenagers on a MAX train after saying racial slurs back on September 2nd was rejected from jail 3 days earlier. Adrian Cummins, who is white, was supposed to be in jail when he allegedly committed attempted murder. He was taken to the Multnomah County Detention Center at least 3 times on different charges in the weeks leading up to those stabbings. So why didn't he stay in jail? He was refused each time for unspecified medical conditions. Medical staff couldn't say exactly why Cummins was turned away from jail because of health privacy laws, but situations where a person swallowed drugs, is severely intoxicated, or has open or infected wounds are all potential reasons why a person might be turned away from jail custody. Through July and August, Cummins was booked on other knife-related charges. One teen who was stabbed by Cummins had to get open-heart surgery because of his injuries. Cummins is now in custody awaiting trial for attempted murder, assault, robbery, and bias charges.
The mayor of Grants Pass appears to have survived the recall against her on Tuesday. That vote won't be final until October 3rd, but for now, Mayor Sarah Bristol seems to have hung on to her seat with about 64% support. The Grants Pass mayor is a volunteer position and is mainly tasked with overseeing city council meetings. The recall effort was initiated by a resident who says Bristol doesn't represent the conservative values of the community and hasn't done enough to address homelessness. Bristol has said that she's trying to balance things, especially in light of a 2020 court ruling that restricts the city from cracking down on public camping. Turnout in this recall election was far lower than in other recent elections.
Rural Americans face unique challenges, and a new report from the Rural Democracy Initiative aims to highlight the need for federal policy actions that could address those needs. That includes everything from shoring up rural hospitals and businesses to improving infrastructure. Mike Moen has more on that story in Minnesota.
Recent policy decisions are being carried out to improve the lives of Minnesota's rural communities. A national coalition says despite the progress, more moves are needed to help small towns thrive. The new 2023 Rural Policy Action Report contains input from nearly 30 organizations. The authors say there are 4 main areas federal lawmakers should focus on to ensure rural communities are set up for success. They include infrastructure investments, taking on corporate mergers, and protecting democracy and natural resources. Eric Hattelstad with the Minnesota group Clean Up the River Environment says small town America remains overlooked.
We did make some really great progress in the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law and others. We still have a long way to go. We have many decades of disinvestment and underinvestment to make up for.
Hattelstad contributed to the report, and he says federal incentives will leverage tens of billions of dollars for rural electric cooperatives and communities as they transition to clean energy sources. But he likens it to a down payment, noting more investments are needed to cover every rural utility. House Republicans are prioritizing spending cuts, and he warns some of those policies could be undone. And for the resources that are currently available, Hattelstad says rural governments need some technical guidance in getting their hands on grants that could transform their communities.
I think that is still a really big concern, and continuing to clear pathways for federal investment to reach rural communities needs to be a big priority.
When it comes to infrastructure, the report says it goes beyond roads, bridges, and broadband upgrades. It says healthcare access, less expensive childcare, and a larger stock of safe and affordable housing are other foundations small towns are in desperate need of to improve the quality of life for residents.
Hedlestad points out the Minnesota legislature helped in many ways this past session, and he hopes other states follow suit in filling gaps. This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
It's National Assisted Living Week. Oregonians say having long-term care available to them is a high priority. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
This week is National Assisted Living Week, highlighting the hard work put in to help older people and people living with disabilities. Many Oregonians hope to stay in their homes as they age, but that often requires long-term care. Stacy Larson is with AARP Oregon.
Oregon is one of the fastest aging states in the country, and as the population ages, these questions of caregiving and long-term quality care are top of mind for many, many people, and that certainly was borne out in our research.
According to AARP's Vital Voices survey, 84% of Oregonians think it's important to get to age in place, and 72% think it's important to have high-quality long-term care in their communities. This legislative session, state lawmakers passed protections for LGBTQ Oregonians in long-term care facilities. Larson says the new law is critical for ensuring that everyone is able to age with dignity. She says the measure prohibits actions based wholly or partially on someone's perceived gender identity, sexual orientation, or HIV status.
Those actions might include denying admission, transfer, or discharge requests, perhaps inappropriate room assignments for transgender patients, and denying or restricting medical or non-medical care.
The people who do the caregiving also are important. Oregon has about 470,000 caregivers who assist loved ones but are not compensated for it. It can be hard to get a break from their duties, but Larson says the state is going to help provide resources.
We have successfully advocated for budget funding for a soon-to-be-created program that would provide respite support services to family caregivers. There is currently very little support for those hundreds of thousands of family caregivers.
Larson notes AARP also has respite resources available for caregivers. This is Eric Tegedoff for Oregon News Service.
Portland Public Schools has announced a tentative agreement with an education workers union. The Portland Federation of School Professionals, or PFSP, represents 1,350 teaching assistants, library workers, and campus safety associates. They have now reached a proposed agreement on a three-year contract with Portland Public Schools. Willamette Week reports that the union was able to negotiate a pay raise that brings compensation for the entire group of education employees that it represents to a minimum of $20 an hour. The agreement also provides cost of living adjustments over the three-year term as well. John McDuffie is the union president of the PFSP. He said, quote, "We are happy that we are able to get those people who were paid so little significant increases," end quote. The proposed agreement now goes to the PFSP members to ratify. This union success, by the way, comes as the school district is reaching an impasse with the Portland Teachers Union. School Superintendent Guadalupe Guerrero warned parents last week that they should prepare for a possible teachers' strike in late October.
The House moves forward with an impeachment inquiry of President Joe Biden. An activist looks to have Donald Trump's federal criminal case televised, and young voters seek sweeping changes. With more on these stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
These are allegations of abuse of power, obstruction, and corruption, and they warrant further investigation by the House of Representatives.
Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy is moving to open a formal impeachment inquiry into whether President Joe Biden benefited from his son Hunter's business dealings. Most of McCarthy's right flank support the move, but other congressional Republicans privately say the long-shot effort is a waste of time that lacks supporting evidence. Polls show well over half of American voters see the inquiry as a partisan stunt. Some, including Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, have said they wouldn't vote for an appropriations bill without it. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is calling for a bipartisan action on the budget.
I think the impeachment inquiry is absurd. The American people want us to do something that will make their lives better, not go off on these chases and witch hunts.
Meanwhile, a petition to televise former President Donald Trump's federal January 6th trial has garnered more than 17,000 signatures. Federal judicial rules prohibit electronic devices in the courtroom, but Jonathan Perlow, the petition's creator, says both supporters and critics of Trump want transparency about the attack on the Capitol.
The one thing we share is we both kind of want to see the evidence put forward with our own eyes. Both sides kind of feel that they're going to be vindicated by seeing it firsthand, but I think that's actually good that something that we otherwise disagree on, we agree that we should be able to see it.
38 members of Congress signed a letter with a similar aim. A separate high-profile court case involving high tech is underway in Washington. Federal and state governments are arguing internet giant Google uses its market dominance to squash competition, including paying to stay the default search engine on smartphones. The company argues they don't stop consumers from using their competition, and it says their product is preferred because it's better. Vice President Kamala Harris is set to go on a month-long college tour to tap into the power of millennial and Gen Z voters, who traditionally lean strongly Democratic. Dakota Hall with the Alliance for Youth Action says these voters want transformational change in policies, especially in the defense of democracy.
These are folks who went to high school and witnessed nothing but on-news coverage on their different social media feeds of Trump, of like dysfunction, of government shutdowns, and then a global pandemic. And so they've seen the worst of what this country can be, and I think they want to push us forward.
Research from the Alliance finds young voters in battleground states focused on two primary issues. More progressive voters see protecting abortion access as a top priority, while those who are more conservative are more concerned about rising inflation. The Government Accountability Office says $135 billion in pandemic unemployment benefits may have been lost to fraud. The GAO estimates up to 15% of the benefits went to people who didn't deserve them. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report interview with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about the vendor issue out this week. At 6, it's Exploration with Michio Kaku. Then at 7, Eco-Justice Radio. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with an overnight low of 60. Tomorrow will be sunny, warm with a high of 88. Today in history, in 2022, Franco-Swiss film director and critic Jean-Luc Godard passed away. He was a pioneer of the French New Wave film movement of the 60s and is arguably the most influential French filmmaker of the post-war era. The quote of the day is from Godard, who said, quote, "Art attracts us only by what it reveals of our most secret self."
Thirty-five were arrested at a rally outside the White House on Tuesday. They were there supporting Leonard Peltier, who's been in prison for nearly half a century, and they're calling on President Biden to pardon him. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Hundreds of supporters of Native activist Leonard Peltier rallied outside the White House on Tuesday, calling on President Joe Biden to grant him clemency. He's been in prison for nearly 50 years. Melinda Tuhus reports.
The day marked Peltier's 79th birthday. He's said to be in poor health and has been imprisoned for the deaths of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Indigenous leaders, allies, and his attorney are calling for Peltier's freedom, saying there's no evidence tying him to the crime, and say exculpatory evidence was withheld at trial. Fawn Sharp was among the speakers at the rally. She's president of the National Congress of American Indians.
The only person on the face of this planet that has the sole decision, it is a choice he has to release Leonard, our relative. We call on the President of the United States, release our elder! Release our elder!
The event included the lifting up of an enormous banner with their demand. The rally was organized by NDN Collective and Amnesty International USA. Sharp, Nick Tilson, President and CEO of NDN Collective, and Paul O'Brien, Executive Director of Amnesty International USA, were arrested outside the White House. According to NDN Collective, the leaders were among 35 people arrested by U.S. Park Police after the U.S. Secret Service cleared people from the rally on Pennsylvania Avenue. Peltier, Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, is incarcerated in a maximum security prison in Florida. Melinda Tuhus, National Native News, Washington, D.C.
Outside the coastal community of Florence, Oregon, a restoration project is underway to convert nearly 200 acres of old dairy farmland into habitat to benefit wildlife, especially salmon. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, a tribe is among partners.
On a flat, muddy area of reddish clay-like soil, an excavator digs away at what will eventually become a primary channel in what used to be a marsh. Jesse Beers examines the site for anything ranging from pottery shards to human remains. He's the cultural stewardship manager for the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians. They're partnering with the Siuslaw Watershed Council and the Mackenzie River Trust on this restoration. Beers says it's an essential collaboration.
During the treaty process, when our treaty wasn't ratified, our lands were never legally ceded. That's part of the reason we see ourselves as such big stewards of our lands and waters. Because we don't really have the population or the capacity anymore to manage those lands as we used to, it's very important for us to work with our partners.
The Siuslaw Estuary Restoration Project is slated to take 2 years at a cost of $10 million. That's on top of the purchase of the dairy farm, which was $750,000 funded by a grant from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. Margaret Treadwell is the Mackenzie River Trust Central Coast Conservation Program Manager. She says the partnership will make a noticeable difference.
You will see the river returned, particularly at the high tides, up into this area that we're looking at right now. So the river will be coming back in here, bringing salt water, creating just a nice passage for fish to come up through here and spend their juvenile time.
When finished, planners say 6 miles of habitat will provide feeding and rearing grounds for salmon, steelhead, and lamprey, as well as shorebirds. There will also be a tribal naming ceremony for the area, and a canoe landing is also part of the design. I'm Brian Bull, outside Florence, Oregon.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Well, school is back in session and activities abound, and that means many parents feel like they're expected to do it all. But what are the effects on people's health as stress levels climb? Farah Siddiqui reports in Missouri.
As fall classes and after-school activities are in full swing, Missouri families can feel the pressure to do it all. But the American Heart Association warns parents that this type of nonstop lifestyle isn't sustainable or healthy. Dr. Peter Penegos, who teaches at Washington University, is also president of the St. Louis American Heart Association board. Penegos says packing too much into a week can be stressful. And week after week, he says chronic stress can lead to negative medical consequences, both for kids and adults.
Poor sleep hygiene, not sleeping as much as required, has impact on your health, your wellness, and your ability to concentrate and learn, which is really important for our kids. Stress can lead to us making poor health decisions as far as the type of food we ingest. We will want to get the most easily accessible food, and often that is food highest in calories.
The Heart Association recommends 30 minutes of daily physical activity, enough to increase your heart rate and to maintain a healthy heart. Penegos says they are family active time, meal prep and meal planning, prioritizing activities, bedtime routines, and the proper amount of rest. Most people know that decisions and habits they develop as children and young adults carry over into adulthood. So Penegos says it's time to help children build the healthiest possible habit.
If we can develop healthy lifestyle practices for our kids as they grow into young adults, teenagers, they can see how we live by example. They will really mimic our healthy behaviors. It doesn't mean we have to change everything at once. We can set goals, take baby steps, teach your kids about heart health, healthy diet. Ultimately, it's going to help them live longer, healthier lives for their own future.
The American Heart Association says it's important to take time for yourself to decompress. These tips and more are on their website, heart.org. For Missouri News Service, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
Biomethane, or renewable natural gas, comes from landfills and waste lagoons. It's being refined and injected into gas pipes, emitting CO2, a much less potent greenhouse gas than methane. Some see it as a climate change fix, but others argue it's a false solution. Suzanne Potter has the details in California.
One of the nation's biggest sources of greenhouse gas is methane, which seeps out of landfills and lagoons of manure. The renewable natural gas industry has sprung up to capture, refine, and inject it into existing natural gas pipelines. However, critics say the process still emits carbon dioxide and other pollutants. Bob Powell is CEO of Brightmark, which captures methane from waste at large dairy farms, including one in the Central Valley. He notes that, as a greenhouse gas, methane is more than 80 times as potent as carbon dioxide over a 20-year period.
The question is, how do we best get to a zero carbon future? And one of the biggest areas that we can do that is taking the food that we're already going to be eating and removing the methane. By harvesting that gas, we're able to avoid the methane being emitted into the atmosphere.
The state offers big subsidies to produce RNG, which is also known as biomethane. Dairy farmers profit by selling credits to oil and gas companies under California's Low Carbon Fuel Standard program. UC Davis professor Aaron Smith says removing methane from the atmosphere is a substantial benefit, but it comes at a cost.
Capturing methane from cow manure does replace fracking that would have been done to pull natural gas out of the ground. In order to incentivize capturing of that methane, we pay large subsidies to farmers and renewable natural gas companies. Those subsidies are probably much larger than the actual value we get from reducing that greenhouse gas.
Some environmental groups object to public funds going to a program that prolongs burning natural gas, a fossil fuel. Stefan Adel is with the New York Renews Coalition.
We recognize climate change is real, and that means moving towards a world where we're dramatically reducing emissions. And those investments can either be reinforcing the fossil fuel infrastructure we have now while calling it renewable, or it can be actually focused on eliminating the combustion of fossil fuels and renewable fuels when they're combined.
This story was produced with original reporting from John Kerry for PNAS. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Flood prevention projects can enhance people's well-being in under-recognized ways. That includes offering space for public recreation, which in turn improves health. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As seas rise and weather becomes more extreme, many communities are investing in flood prevention projects. Some are creating rain gardens or other green spaces that absorb and hold water. Others are restoring coastal dunes that can help protect inland areas. These projects can be expensive, so Tess Deffinger of the University of Alabama says that as cities weigh the pros and cons, it's important to realize that flood prevention can do more than just protect property. For example, reducing flooding also helps protect people's health and well-being.
There's a reduced chance of disease outbreak after a storm or a flood event. Just even that extra sense of safety, so mentally, psychologically, having that there can also help.
Deffinger encourages communities to design projects that help residents in other ways, too.
Could you add in an additional recreation area, like as a buffer between the river and the city, like a city walk, things like that, that could actually add some additional space for the city for people to use?
She says talking about and designing for these co-benefits can help engage residents and attract investors. And their support can help ensure that critical flood prevention projects get done. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, September 13th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao, David Rosenberg, and Reed Johnson. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edward J. Vieira, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Farah Siddiqui, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member, and we sure hope you will, support our programming by going to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, and have a great night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community. Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Today, I'm speaking with Street Roots Editor-in-Chief Kay Rambo about the latest edition of the paper, The Vendor Issue, Around the Network and Back Again. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on to talk with us about this new issue. So the latest issue has a lot of exciting elements. What are some of the different things that readers can expect from this edition?
The most immediately recognizable one is probably color. This is a color issue, but it is, as you said, it's the vendor issue, just an annual thing we do. The theme for this year is Around the Network and Back Again. So in addition to including poetry and some Q&As with Street Roots vendors, there's also content about and in some cases written by vendors from other street papers within the International Network of Street Papers.
So one of the things in this issue is detailing the plans for Street Roots' new building on West Burnside and what vendors are most looking forward to in the new space. What can you tell me about the moving process and what the new building will be like? I don't think we've gotten the chance to talk about that on here yet.
Yeah, it's on West Burnside and 3rd, kind of right there around some Portland landmarks like Voodoo Donuts and Dante's. It is a four-story building, including the basement, which if anyone listening has seen Street Roots' current office, it is a lot more space for us to operate with. It was really nice to hear what the vendors were most excited about. A lot of that had to do with the basement, which will include showers,